Whenever you like.
This is an oral history recording at Westminster School on the 18th of August 2015 with Elizabeth Wells, archivist,
Charlotte Robinson, archives assistant,
and
George Law, an alumnus.
Perhaps we can begin by talking a little bit about your family background.
Yes, I had an elder brother who was also at Westminster and also a King's Scholar. My father was an advertising agent, although he had a most interesting career in the Second World War in SOE, where he became a spymaster. My mother was even more remarkable for her generation. She was a graduate at Cambridge, although in those days women could not get degrees and she couldn't actually get her degree until 1948. It was different at Oxford. When she came down from Cambridge during the First World War, she went into the civil service. But when the First World War was over, she got a job in the glove department of Selfridges, which is where she met my father, who was in the publicity department of Selfridges at the time. What was remarkable is, although my mother was not beautiful, she was very striking because she was very tall. She was 5'11", and she was handsome rather than beautiful. And Mr. Selfridge noticed people like that, and he found out about her and her background. And he sent for her and said, "A bright young woman like you is wasting your time working here, but I think I may be able to help you," he said. He said, "My friends at Marshall Field in Chicago," and of course Gordon Selfridge himself came, "sorry, I beg your pardon, my friends at Sears Roebuck in Chicago have just bought the Encyclopedia Britannica because they think they can sell it by mail order. I think they are wrong, but that's what they think." And he said, "I think they could use a bright young woman like you with your sort of background, and if you would like me to, I will talk to General Wood, who is the chief executive of Sears Roebuck in Chicago, and see if he's interested." So my mother said, "Yes, better than working in the glove department at Selfridges." So she got a summons from the Encyclopedia Britannica in Chicago. She went to Chicago, was interviewed, was given a job at the Encyclopedia Britannica in this country. By about 1930, she was general manager of the whole of the Encyclopedia Britannica. That she remained until 1943, when a publishing company called George Nunes, who were primarily magazine publishers but also published some books, bought the rights to Chambers' Encyclopedia. And their idea was to bring out a new edition of Chambers' Encyclopedia after the end of the Second World War, whenever that was, because in 1943 one did not know. So they hired my mother to start planning a new edition of Chambers' Encyclopedia and to start hiring the people who would be needed to supervise all that. Anyway, to cut a long story short, she successfully edited and produced a new edition of Chambers' Encyclopedia, which was published in 1951. For that, she got an MBE, and she continued working until she finally retired when she was 68. Those are my parents. My elder brother had three children, a pair of twins, called Jennifer and Nicholas, and a younger girl called Katie. They all came to Westminster, although none of their children have. I married in 1960. My wife and I had a daughter in 1962. She initially went to Wickham Abbey, but then decided she wanted to be back in London, and in particular wanted to be at Westminster. So she got a place at Westminster. What is interesting was, we thought, when she came to Westminster, her first real comment would be about working alongside boys. It wasn't. She said after two or three days, I knew that the maths and science teaching at Wickham Abbey was not great, but it was not until I came here that I realised it was third rate. She had an initial problem because she was very good at maths and science, and she wanted to take double maths at A level. But the then senior maths master, James Perry, said, I'm sorry, you haven't done enough maths at Wickham Abbey so that you can do that. When, at the end of her first term, she got 100% in her end of term maths exams, James Perry came to her and said, look, if you are prepared to give up some of your time in the Christmas holidays, I am prepared to come give up some of my time, and I will teach you the maths that you were not taught at Wickham Abbey, so that you can do double maths at A level. So she did, and she did extremely well in her A levels. What's interesting is that I myself, unlike so many of my contemporaries, I wanted to go up to Cambridge, but I didn't want to go up to Trinity because there was going to be a post-war bulge of boys, and I didn't want to be at a college where a very high proportion of the boys will be our worthlesses. I wanted to go somewhere else. So I succeeded in winning a scholarship at Clare College, Cambridge, which amazed the people at Westminster. Why don't you want to go up to Trinity? So I told them why. Anyway, I went up to Clare. So when it came to the question of my daughter, she wanted to go up to Cambridge, being a scientist and mathematician. She had an inclination to try for Clare, but at that stage, Clare was going through an extraordinary period when it had a very eccentric master who was determined to produce basically academics, an intellectual elite. And the staff at Westminster said to my daughter, they said, you're very bright, but you don't have the sort of intellect of a potential academic. Therefore, I don't think you should try for Clare. They said, Keyes has just started to take women. They're looking for bright girls. We suggest you should apply to Keys. So she did. She won a scholarship. And there are one or two of her Westminster contemporaries also went out. Keys in particular, a boy who has become a very successful doctor called Mark Lipman, and they've remained lifelong friends ever since school, and she's still in touch with a lot of her other Westminster contemporaries. That's sort of a family background for you. Does that help you?
Very much.
Right.
Where was your family home based in your early years before you came to Westminster?
It was a place called Ewell, which was near Epsom in Surrey, which was, in those days, quite countrified. You wouldn't recognise it now because it's all built up. But it was very easy to commute to London. So it was no problem for my parents because there was a station within, 10 minutes walk. And it was a half-hour commute to Waterloo. So that's why I bought it. It was very nice because it was a house that had been built in the 1920s. It had a big garden, about a quarter of an acre, that all the houses did. And because my brother and I played a lot of games, there was plenty of room to play games in the garden without doing too much damage or kicking the football over into the neighbour's garden too often. It happened at times, but and then when the war came, Second World War, it was not too difficult to keep half the garden as a garden and make the other half of the garden a kitchen garden where one could grow vegetables, even keep hens, and people did. It was, we stayed there until 1945, and then my parents bought a house at a village called Merstham, Merstham, close to Red Hill, also in Surrey, which had an even bigger garden, and it was a converted school. It had been built as a school in the 1890s, and then had been the village school. Then it had been abandoned and converted into a house. And the great thing about it was it had enormous space. You could have, there was room to have a table, tennis table permanently erected at three-quarter size, billiard table there all the time. So it was a wonderful place for children to play around in. There was lots of space. And basically I went on living there, really until I got married. The reason was that when I left school, I went into the army. I was called up. I went into the army for about 18 months. And, but because I knew I was going up to Cambridge, there was no difficulty in getting released, what would have been slightly early, in order not to miss a year at Cambridge. When I came down, I knew what I wanted to be. I wanted to become a solicitor. So when I came down from Cambridge, I managed to become what would now be called a trainee. In those days, they were called articled clerks. But the trouble about being an articled clerk was you didn't get paid for 3 years. Indeed, your your parents had to pay what was called a premium of 100 a year for the privilege of your going to work, and worked extremely hard at that, but one learnt it as well in the process. So there was no way that one could afford to live away from home. And when I finally qualified in 1955, then aged 26, I got paid the princely sum of 500 a year, which of course would be worth a great deal more now than it was then, but it still wasn't exactly princely. And it was not until really just before I got married that I was told that as soon as there was a vacancy, I would be made a partner in the firm. And they put my salary up to what seemed riches in those days. It was 2,000 a year. That was in late 1959. So that takes me to the beginning of my career, really. So
what was your education like before coming to Westminster? Did you go to a prep school?
I went to, I think it was a very, very good prep school called Downs End in Leatherhead. It was an offshoot, really, of a, it was started by a chap called Linford, who originally had a prep school in Hampstead, and then set up this school in Leatherhead. And Linford was a remarkable man because he was rather like a first-class racehorse trainer. He really understood his boys, and he knew precisely which public schools they were likely to get into and which they weren't, and at which public schools, if they were bright enough, they were likely to win the scholarship. And his greatest achievement was actually in 1932, when in that year three of his boys won scholarships at Winchester. I think it's practically unknown for one prep school to have three Winchester scholars in a single year. But he said to my parents about my elder brother and me, he said they might just win scholarships at Winchester, but I don't think so, but I think they will win the scholarships at Westminster. So we both tried to get scholarships at Winchester and did not succeed, but we both got scholarships at Westminster, for which I am actually rather grateful, because I think Westminster is a much, much more civilized school and a much better preparation for life than Winchester. But it was a very good prep school, and it had some fascinating features. Linford believed that what he was really doing was educating his boys to go out and govern the empire, or otherwise represent the country in some part of the world. Therefore, my parents were very surprised to find that all boys, from the very smallest, had ballroom dancing lessons. So my parents, all a suitable, and it was brilliant, really, because the great problem with all the very young boys like that is, if I'm going to have a termly dance, which they did, who are they going to dance with? I mean, they couldn't possibly dance with girls from another school. They were far too shy to do that. So Linford recruited all the mothers and said, you all come and dance with my boys. They won't worry about dancing with somebody else's mother. And my parents said, it's very interesting, this Mr. Linford. Why do you think it's necessary that the boy should learn to dance? Well, said Linford, I mean, you never know where they may end up. And think how embarrassing it would be if one of my boys was en poste at the embassy in Vienna and he did not know how to do a reverse turn in the waltz. It would not do. And it was an immensely civilized school in that way, and there were a lot of games. It had very, very good playing fields. It had this amazing academic record. I think both my brother and I enjoyed it enormously, as indeed we enjoyed our time at Westminster, I have to say. Right, let's carry on.
So, you must have had some knowledge of the school before you came, because your older brother was there.
Yes, he was still here when I came. Yes, I mean, I think that he came here really on the advice of Linford, the prep school headmaster. My brother came here. It was natural that if I didn't get into Winchester, my father had been at Winchester, that I should try for Westminster as well, which I did, and that was fine. And I don't regret it in the slightest. Indeed, I am delighted that I did. And so many at the time I came, so many schools had been disrupted anyway, that the fact that Westminster was evacuated was not all that relevant. I mean, because so many schools had been, and in the event, I think, because of what one had to do to cope with the conditions of the evacuation, it was an extremely good thing, and one acquired a sort of self-reliance and one had experiences that just wouldn't have happened if one had gone to a school like, say, Charterhouse, that had stayed in its ordinary premises. I mean, one just would not have got those experiences. And I think they were extremely valuable. And the interesting thing, I've said this repeatedly, despite the conditions of the evacuation, I don't think the educational standards slipped at all. I think the remaining staff did the most amazing job in educating us, and I just don't believe that the standard of the education really suffered. I mean, you're right, it was difficult, but you got on with it. And the sort of thing that was, I think, quite important. College was evacuated, you probably know all this, to Whitbourne Hall, which hadn't been lived in for a very long time, which had a moat, and it had big gardens, including a very big kitchen garden. And the owner's old head gardener whose name was Armstrong, I remember. He was still there. And in order to have fresh vegetables, once or twice a week, instead of playing games, which is quite difficult anyway, you went and did a stint in the garden under the supervision of Armstrong, which is very good for one. The other thing was, round this, the moat, there were a lot of trees, mature trees, and of course there was a chronic fuel shortage. And we thought, well, you know, this hasn't been lived in for a very long time, they're not going to miss the odd tree. And it was a tradition of the Boy Scout troop, of whom I was one, that during the summer holidays, they used to go off and camp, probably in the Lake District, somewhere like that, where there were big forestry commission plantations, and work for the forestry commission, who were chronically short of labour. I mean, basically the only labour the Forestry Commission had were Germans who'd been interned who would rather work for the Forestry Commission than just sit in an internment camp doing nothing. So, if you went off on the scout camp to do forestry, you learned how to cut down trees. So, we knew how to cut down trees in those days, which is before the days of chainsaws. The safest way to cut them down, because it was much easier to control, was with an axe in the old-fashioned way. So periodically, those of us who knew how to cut down trees, we used to cut down one of these trees around the moat. And we would fell it into the moat, because it would do the least possible damage if it fell in the moat. We would then mobilise a team of boys with ropes to pull the tree out of the moat, so that we could on back onto the bank, so that we could then cut it up, which we did. You know, all that sort of thing was extremely good for one. The other thing that I think was kept one fit and also made one more self-reliant. As you probably know, the school was basically in two centres. It was in Whitbourne and near Bromyard at Buckenhill, which were about 5 miles apart. And, right, school was 2 days a week in one centre and 3 days a week in the other, and it alternated. And whilst there was a fairly decrepit coach and a certain amount of fuel which used to transport the more elderly members of staff and boys who were convalescent from one centre to the other, the only other means of transport for us and for the rest of the staff was bike. So 2 or 3 days a week you used to have to bike 5 miles to school and then 5 miles back again. And that was actually a very good thing to do, because one would have time off at the weekends and that sort of thing. And there became no control over where one went. So one used to cycle all over all sorts of places in Worcestershire. I mean, even into Worcester itself. It's about 15 miles, but so what? And, you know, that was the sort of experience that one would not have got in any other way, and I think it was extremely valuable.
Do you remember the scholarship exam itself? Do you remember sitting it? And where did you take it?
I remember, and I did it at school. I actually did it at my prep school. I mean, it's simply they're trying to avoid bringing people into central London in 1942, because whilst the worst of the air raids were over, they were still going on, and so it was a risk that was to be avoided if possible. So I actually did it at my prep school under supervision. That's where I did it. Set that. Same with the. Now I went to Winchester to do the Winchester exam. I did them 2 weeks apart. I did the Winchester exam and find I'd failed, and then did the Westminster exam and got it. So.
And do you remember the journey to Westminster the first time, or not to Westminster, I suppose, to the school?
Oh, yeah. Yes. Well, having an elder brother was a help, so it was not that was familiar to him. It was a journey in what was a rather decrepit train from Paddington. That seemed to stop an inordinate number of turns. I can't remember which station we got to. Anyway, we all piled into cages that had somehow been obtained that took us to, in my case, to Whitwell. I think our trunks were probably taken separately, but I can't remember the detail of that. But by the time I got there, the conditions in Whitbourne Hall were not too bad. I mean, they were a bit primitive, but there were two great pluses about it. Well, several. One was we had this kitchen garden, so we grew a lot of stuff. The other was that the house, the college house butler, a chap called John Fennell, he had come to Whitbourne with us. And more importantly, so had his wife. And his wife was a professional cook who used, before the war, to go and to people's private houses and cook dinner for dinner parties. So she was a great cook. And, of course, in the country, there was a thriving black market, and nobody was going to ignore that. So we grew a lot of our own projects. We got rather more than normal rations. And it was cooked by Mrs. Fennell. So actually, in some ways, we ate much better than we did at home. Which was remarkable, really, in the circumstances. But it was an experience.
What do you remember about the food? What were your favourites?
Well, the one thing you couldn't do anything about was meat. And that was always in short supply, except possibly for chicken, for a certain amount of chicken. But no, I think one ate enormous quantities of vegetables, which is, you know, fine. I mean, you might survive on that. I mean, nobody was malnourished. I mean, indeed, we were much better off than most of the population. And one of the great things, it's probably the right time to mention it, if you went on these scout camps working for the Forestry Commission, for the duration, you were an agricultural worker for rationing purposes, which meant you got double food rations, which was extremely important. Extremely important. The other thing about working for the Forestry Commission is we actually got paid, but we got paid on a piecework basis. And essentially what we were doing was we were cutting down mature conifers. And stripping off all the branches and then cutting them to the exact length that was required for them to be wooden pit props in the mines. Because most of the pit props in those days were wooden, not steel, as they are now. And you can imagine it, you know, cutting down a tree, stripping the branches off, then cutting it into the right length for the crosscut saw. It takes a little time. And we actually got paid, well, what was then a farthing, which is 1/4 of an old penny. So it's about a tenth of a new penny for each pit prop. Not exactly over generous, but still, it was better than nothing. It's the first money I ever really earned. Now we used to pool it and split it up at the end of the camp, so everybody got the same share. But it was a lot of fun. Right.
Did you see much of your parents during this time if you were away in the holidays working?
Not a lot, no. Well, a lot of the time my father was abroad, so it was really only my mother, when she was working anyway. But there was about a mile and a half from Whitbourne, there was a big country house that belonged to a family called Wrigley. Very, very nice people. And they made arrangements to put up visiting parents on a bed and breakfast basis. So parents would come for the weekend and spend it in the Wrigley's house. And then basically we used to visit them because we had transport in the form of bike. Whereas our parents didn't have any transport. And there wasn't all that much transport available in rural Worcestershire. Actually, it's very interesting. The Wrigleys had 7 daughters, most of whom got married. One of them married, he was actually became a general called Witts, W-I-T-T-S. And their son, Francis Witts, came to Westminster. But I knew Francis, I suppose I was about 14, when Francis was, in effect, a baby. But although he was just talking, because people were very amused, because when boys came, all boys were either George, which was me, or not George, which was another boy. And I've kept in touch with Francis pretty well ever since, which is nice actually, because they're but That's a war on soul, one's parents, but that's, you know, I'm all this business of exeats and parents visiting is really a post-war phenomenon. I mean, it just didn't exist in it up to the end of the Second World War. I mean, when my mother was at school, I mean, she was at St. Andrews, and her parents lived in Liverpool, and there was no way that they were going to go and visit her in St. Andrews. My father was at school at Winchester, and his parents, when his mother lived in Yorkshire, and there was no way she was going to visit him in Winchester. So, you know, it just didn't happen. It just didn't happen. And you just got on with it. I mean, I think it was tough on the staff that they had us all the time, but we didn't mind because we weren't expecting it. You know, you went away at the beginning of term and right, 10 weeks later or whenever, you come home again. But that was it. So, there we are.
So you said the boarding conditions were primitive, you said. What were they like?
Well, I mean, nothing had been seriously redecorated for, oh, I don't know, 20 years. I mean, it was reasonably... it was reasonably okay. But, I mean, nothing would be done simply because, I mean, things like toilet were just not available. I mean, they just, you couldn't go out and buy a pot of paint just like that. So there was no way that you could really redecorate the place, even if you wanted to, and even if you could get the labour to do it, you couldn't do it. You couldn't get the materials. It happened before my time, but somehow or other, we were very lucky in that one of the staff who came down to Worcestershire was the senior music master, whose name was Arnold Foster. He was a very remarkable man. And he managed to beg, borrow and steal enough materials to convert the stables at Whitbourne into music rooms, so that in fact it sounds there was really quite a lot of music going on. The other thing Arnold Foster did was he was really a very good choral conductor, so virtually the whole of the school, even if you couldn't sing, participated in the choir that he was going to train. And at the same time, he managed to assemble and train two amateur choirs in the area. And about, I think it was once a year, there would be a grand concert where all the school choir and these two other choirs would all perform together in public. So Arnold was a most remarkable man, and he could teach one way or another practically any instrument if you would get hold of an instrument. I mean, Arnold would try and teach it. I mean, I didn't learn an instrument because neither did my older brother, because I, in particular, spent too much time playing games when I could. Which, and again, you know, the facilities for playing games in during evacuation or even back in London, they were pretty primitive. I mean, we managed to rent a field from a farmer that wasn't much used for anything else. There's a sort of soccer pitch, so I can play soccer. And a lot of us worked extremely hard to create the surface that was good enough to have cricket nets in one corner of this field. So somehow I managed to play games. The other great thing about it was I enjoyed cricket. I mean, I played both soccer and cricket, but when we did manage to play school matches, we used to play most of them. We played up what you might call our home matches against other schools on the Worcester County ground, which was quite an experience. And I was lucky. I played there a number of times because I was quite good. The school was very small. So I got into the school cricket side really very young. I was in it for 4 years. That added to it in a different way. There was an immense amount of physical activity one way or another, which was a very good thing. We were all frightfully fit. We had to be. We couldn't survive otherwise. I mean, if you were cycling, I don't know. I mean, one way or another, I should think it was about 100 miles a week, if not more. So, you know. But it was fine. One just accepted it. That was part of life. You've just gone on with it. Right. Where do we go next?
Which were the subjects that you enjoyed the most?
I enjoyed classics. I really enjoyed classics. I was reasonably good at maths, but classics is what I really enjoyed. And I was very lucky because because of the shortage of staff, the senior classics forms were taught mainly by John Christie, the headmaster. And, he was a very, very good classical scholar. And he was an absolutely brilliant teacher of clever boys. You had to be a clever boy. He had no patience with stupid boys. He was no good teaching stupid boys. But, If you were clever and prepared to work hard, he was absolutely terrific as a teacher. He was a much better teacher than in some ways he was as a headmaster, I think. He was a good headmaster, although I disagreed with him on a lot of things. A lot of people were frightened of him. I wasn't. He couldn't understand why people like me wanted to play games. And I said, I think it's very important, and nothing is going to stop me. I am going to play games. I'm going to work as well, but I'm going to play games. And that was sort of alien to his way of thinking. I ended up mainly due to him, I think, because of what he taught me. in my first years at Westminster, and he still taught them back in London as well. And I won a classical scholarship at Cambridge, so I can't criticise that. That just shows you that the quality of the education did not deteriorate despite the conditions, both during evacuation and the early years back in London. Because I won an open scholarship in competition with boys from all over the place. And so did a lot of other people.
Do any of the other masters stand out in your memory?
Well, there was my house master, David Simpson, who was also a classics teacher, and he was very good. A terribly nice man with a most delightful wife. And some of the others do, mainly for their what you might call eccentricities. I mean, one of the most remarkable was Claridge, the modern languages teacher, who was, I think, a very good teacher, although he didn't really teach me. He was the school cynic. Claridge didn't mince his words, and when he thought other members of staff were wrong, he used to say something in no uncertain terms. The other thing about Claridge was I can't remember the exact date. I think it was just about, must have been about 1942 when I went to school. Claridge realised that it was extremely difficult to get hold of books unless you were a proper bookseller. So Claridge decided that the thing to do was to set up a bookshop in Bromyard, near to where the other half of the school was, which he would run in his spare time, and he'd get other people to run it when he wasn't there. Because this would enable the school to get books that they wouldn't otherwise be able to get. And he was very successful. And it became, I mean, because Claridge was very able, I mean, this bookshop was a tremendous success, and it was the best bookshop for miles and miles and miles around. And when the school came back to London, Claridge said he wanted to, when he was fairly elderly by that stage, he said, "I'm going to stay in Bromyard and continue to run the bookshop. That will be my pension." So he did. The other master I remember particularly, it was the senior science master called Earp. He was a very interesting man, and he was a great inventor. And I always remember, I mean, in those days, there were two kinds of bicycle freeze beam gear. There's the one that's the hub, and there's another one, which is the derailleur, which is the outside one. And that worked out that if you could combine the two, then you would have a 9-speed gear instead of a 3-speed gear. So he managed to construct a bicycle which combined the two kinds of 3-speed gear, so that he was the only person in the country who had a bicycle with a 9-speed gear to help him deal with the fairly steep hills that there were in that part of Worcestershire. But that was a wonderful practical demonstration science at work, if you like. So I remember he was a very nice man. Well, they were all very nice. Those two in particular outside, the ones who mainly taught me. The other one I remember, he was Murray Ross, who taught maths, but he didn't teach me for, he only taught me for a year, because at that time you did school certificate as it then was, as soon as it was reckoned you were capable of doing it. So the brighter boys did it at the end of their first year and then proceeded to specialise. So I did school certificate at the end of year one and then specialised in classics for 4 years. I'm not sure it was a very good system, but anyway, it was the system at the time. And the other real thing I remember Murray Ross taught was he was the commander of the officers' trading corps, which I didn't want to join. Not because I was in any way a pacifist, it was because I knew I was, unless the war ended unexpectedly, going to have to do military service anyway. And I didn't want to do it before I had to. So I didn't, and I became a Boy Scout instead, who had the choice. And I think the Boy Scouts had a lot more fun. And so those are the members of Starbuck. Oh yes, I also remember there was a, because he used to come with the Boy Scouts, there was an English teacher called Snelling, who also taught me in my first year. And then in charge of the scouts as well, there was a biology teacher called Lawrence Bird, who was also the house master of Busbits, and I remember him. Well, he was in charge of the Boy Scouts. Very, very, very close now. So, those are the members of the staff I remember particularly. But it was a long time ago.
What was the hierarchy like within the school? Was discipline organised by some of the older boys?
Yes. Oh, yes. I mean, if necessary, the elder boys had, it would be disapproved of. They had no hesitation if they thought it appropriate to beat a boy. What was a much better form of punishment? I always thought. And again, this was imposed by the senior boys rather than the staff. Was to make, rather than write lines, which was just a waste of time, you were given a piece of verse that you had to learn by heart. It might be Shakespeare, or if you were studying classics, it might be a piece of Greek or Latin verse. And you had to learn this and within a limited time. And you had to be, at the end of that time, absolutely word perfect, or you were in trouble. Serious trouble. And you then got a longer piece of verse that you had to go and do again. But actually it was a very, very good form of punishment, because it was not a waste of time. And a lot of what one learnt by heart, particularly the English verse, stuck with one for the rest of one's life. And I always remember when school was back in London, when I occasionally had to learn verse for that purpose, I used to go out into the cloisters and I'd walk round and round the cloisters learning this verse, because it was absent in the evening. It was absolutely peaceful and you weren't going to be disturbed. So you could, and you'd say, right, I'm going to learn these two lines on this circuit, and the next circuit I'll learn another two lines. And it worked that way. But it was a very good form of punishment. Much better than beating people, really. And much better than wasting time just writing lines, because people did get something out of it. But yes, no, the boys exercise a lot more discipline then, and I think they do now, probably. Yeah. I mean, when I was a senior monitor back in London, the then head of the school, Roddy Williams, who is a contemporary of mine, he wanted to abolish beating. I said, I think, Roddy, that would be a mistake. I mean, I don't approve beating points any more than you do. But I think to remove the ultimate threat is a mistake. I think you want to keep it just in case. Not, you don't have to use it any more than you have to use a nuclear weapon. It's the fact that it's there that matters. But he didn't agree with me, but I still think I was right.
What was it like when the school returned to Westminster?
Well, it was still very small. And Vincent Square was effectively out of use, so the only playing fields were the ones at Grove Park. And college was not functioning because it was an empty shell. The Busby Library was an empty shell. They had managed to roof over the school with congregated art, so that was usable. But I mean, the houses had to be in a lot of the wrong places. It didn't matter to me, but it did to other people. Things like the science facilities were pretty inadequate, but they were there, and people managed. And one of the things I always remember, because I was in college, you had to be a boarder, because you had to be on duty most weekends, not every weekend, you go home for the occasional weekend. And but the thing was that after you done your stuff in the Abbey on Sunday morning, which we have to do, you were in theory free to go anywhere in London, provided you told the member of staff where you were going, and he agreed it was somewhere that it was acceptable to go. I mean, if you were caught going somewhere else, and in particular if you were caught in a pub, there was absolute hell to pay, rightly so. But you know, you were trusted to do what you said you would do. And I thought this is a a very, very civilised and proper attitude. Because it, you can't control what the day bots do when they walk out through the school gates. No way can you. So it's right to treat the board as in this reasonable, what I think is a perfectly reasonable and civilised way. And it was very beneficial, actually, because for me, I was interested in the arts, and there was the National Gallery and the National Portrait Gallery, within walking distance. So I used to spend a lot of Sunday afternoons there, just looking at the paintings. The school got bigger, the staff got bigger. The average age of the staff got younger with the returning warriors. Eventually, not long before I left, Vincent Square became usable after a fashion, but only after a fashion. It wasn't fully reinstated till after I'd left. We used to play home school cricket matches at Wimbledon, who were very kind and lent the school the ground, mainly through there was an old Westminster called Cyril Simpson, who lived in Wimbledon, was a member of the Wimbledon Cricket Club, and I think he'd been a great benefactor of the Wimbledon Cricket Club. I think he was one of the keenest, but one of the worst cricketers in terms of skill that I'd ever met in my life. But he was the most delightful man, very, very nice. And you know, going and playing at Wimbledon was fun. It's a lovely ground. And one of my chief claims to fame is that in 1947, I was the first boy to make 100 for the school in the school match since 1938. That was against Lancing at Wimbledon in 1947. And the other thing we used to do in those early days, as far as the cricket club was concerned, in the first week of the summer holidays, they tried to organise matches that we do normally play during term time, but couldn't, like against Charterhouse at Haddon rather than Charterhouse, and against the Earl Westminsters. And I remember in 1946, I think it was the first time we did it, playing against Charterhouse, and we managed to borrow the ground at St John's Leatherhead. It's a very nice ground, and I remember it so well because it was the first time I came across a chap who, he was, I suppose, one of the best cricketers who ever played for England, Peter Mack. We were almost exactly the same age, and I played against him in 46 and 47, and then we were actually up at Cambridge at the same time, so I knew him there as well. But there he was. With a great deal of ingenuity was exercised mainly by the staff, really, in organising these things. I mean, the boys had ideas, but it was the staff who had to actually implement them. It would have been nice if Vincent Square had been functioning and all that, but one doesn't really seem to miss out. We also, I mean, some other people who were on the ground we used to be able to borrow was the Bank of England ground at Roehampton, which was, they were absolutely lovely, the Bank of England facilities at Roehampton. Terrific. So, it didn't really matter all that much. And somehow or other, one managed. And actually, coming back to London, and because rationing was still on, the food was a great deal worse than it had been down in Worcestershire. That's what happened to survive on normal food rations and what was not available to the population generally, instead of being able to take advantage of being in the country. But again, one survived.
Did you take the meals in College Hall?
Yes, yes, yes. Now that was good because the dean at that time was a very nice man called Alan Dong, and I think there was a shortage of staff in the deanery, and I don't think Alan Dong's wife liked cooking very much. Anyway, quite frequently, Alan Don used to come into College Hall in order to have lunch with us. Because then he didn't have to cook for himself. He could get a free lunch off the school. And he used to sit with the senior boys. So we got to know him quite well. And that was very interesting. And also I think probably partly because some of us got to know the dean quite well, we also got to know some of the other members of the chapter, particularly the ones who lived in the little cloister. And I remember one in particular, he, frightfully nice man, a retired Oxford academic called Adam Fox, who was a cabin, and he had a very nice house in Little Cloister. And he used to like to talk to boys. He's a very interesting man. And occasionally he'd ask a couple of boys to tea. That was very interesting. Talking about having tea with people, one of the most prominent Earl Westminster at the time, immediately post Second World War, was a chap called Ronald Graham, who was a solicitor and a bachelor and a great benefactor of the school. And he, at that time, owned a very remarkable house in Melbury Road in Kensington that William Burgess, the 19th century architect, poet, had designed for himself. And at that time, Ronald Graham had in the house most of the furniture that William Burgess had actually designed for the house. And periodically, Ronald Graham would ask two or three senior boys, to go and have tea in this house. And I wish then I'd known what I know now about William Burgess, because there can be very few people still alive who actually remember or went to the house when it was still fully furnished with, because when Ronald Graham died in, I think it was 1951, shortly after that, although I think the contents were probably left to, I think technically they were left to John Betjeman, but anyway, soon after that, that they were actually sold and that they're now dispersed. It's the house that now belongs to Jimmy Page of Led Zeppelin fame, who has managed to buy back some of the contents, I think, but not very much. I'd love to see inside it, but in practical terms, you can't. But it, you know, I had a very interesting time, and I met very interesting people. I think it was partly because the school was so small still. I don't know how many, when it got down to, what, about 170, I think, at lowest. And I suppose after the war it got back up to about, before I left, it was probably back up to about 300, I should think. But because we've been together for a long time, I mean, all the senior boys knew one another very well. So.
Do you remember the Grease in 1946, the first Grease back in?
Oh, yes. I didn't participate in it. Was it won by Dick Lowe, Charles Lowe's son? I think it may have been. Dick was a great friend of mine. Very, very nice man. Sorry, Charles Lowe's father. Charles Lowe's father. And, of course, Dick Lowe's wife, Charles Lowe's father, Sheila Hillary, was the daughter of a woman called Hillary, who was the matron of college throughout the war, and was the widow of a chap who had been housemaster of Busby's. So there was a very strong school connection there. And Dick was, he was a year older than me, but we played a lot of games together, and we became great friends. And the school, it was different, but I think it was more fun in a way, because you knew most of the boys in the school, because it was so small.
How did it seem to you when you sent your own daughter here? How do you think it changed in those intervening years?
Well, I think because you've been able to get well, like old normal staff, if I can put it well, right, rather than a preponderance of elderly men. It was a better atmosphere, but she, I think, was very lucky because she was one of the girls who was put in college, and at that time the master of the by then Queen's College was a chap called Jim Coker, and she got to know Jim Coker and his wife extremely well, who were very, very kind to her. And indeed, on one occasion, when my wife and I were away, I think I had to go abroad on business, my wife had to come with me. The Kogans simply put her up, and she lived in the Kogans' house for 2 or 3 weeks, which was it was a very, very nice atmosphere for her. She much enjoyed it, which is why she sent her own children here. Yes, I think it was back to normal, as it were, by the time she came. I still think it's... Well, the thing I think about it is it's not only academically the tops, but I also think from what my daughter's experience and my grandchildren's experience, it's one of the most civilized schools in the country. It combines sort of tolerance for discipline and academic excellence in a way that is unusual, shall we say. And I think that's what makes it, amongst other things, such a very, very good school. That's my feeling. How are we doing?
Good. I wondered if there's anything you wanted to say that we haven't given you the chance to say.
I don't think so. I think I don't think I've got any particular apocryphal stories that I've forgotten to relate. But I really enjoyed my time here. So did my daughters, so my two grandsons, and my younger grandson continues to do so, I know that. And it has the facilities to enable people to combine, do so many things. It's great sadness to me, but none of my grandchildren are interested in games, but they're all very musical, and the grandson who's here at the moment, he manages to. Well, he sings in the National Youth Choir. He plays the piano pretty well. I mean, he was second in the piano competition for boys of his age. He also plays the cello in the school orchestra. But because he's not interested in playing gigs, ball gigs, he's able to fence, it's a very good thing that sort of facility is there. Nobody thinks that there's anything odd about you because you don't want to play ball games. The other interesting thing about him is, and I think probably most of the boys know this, but he is actually potentially an extremely talented ballet dancer. And he has, once a week, he has dancing lessons. Now, in other schools, people would say, well, that's very strange. But nobody does at Westminster. Because there's that sort of civilized outlook and tolerance that you don't find at all schools. That, to me, is what makes Westminster unique. I know no other school except just possibly Eton, which is like that, and has the academic excellence as well, because it's the combination of the two that really makes it. So I think that's my final stanza.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Have you got what you want? I hope so.
Very much. Thank
you. It's been
fun.
I've enjoyed it.